I was born in a small town called Masjid Suleiman in southern Iran.
I was born in Syria.
I was born in Hamburg, Germany.
I was born in Kuwait.
I was born in Tanzania in refugee camp.
I was born in Singapore.
Guatemala. I'm from Ireland.
I was born in Thailand refugee camp.
I was born in Mumbai.
I was born in Vientiane, Laos.
I was born in India.
I was born in Costa Rica.
Welcome to Many Roads to Here, bringing the voices of immigrants, refugees, and asylum seekers to a national conversation about migration and identity. I'm your host, Amal Al-Hil. This episode contains discussion of sexual violence, which may be distressing or triggering for some listeners. Please take care of your mental and emotional well-being and feel free to skip this episode if the subject matter is too difficult. If you or someone you know is affected by these issues, consider seeking support from a trusted resource or professional. Rukshan Hafez Trim was born in Beira, a small town in the southeast African country of Mozambique. The coastal community had been colonized by the Portuguese since the 15th century, which eventually led to a decades-long civil war, ultimately putting Rukshana's family at risk. What followed was a childhood, or lack thereof, filled with running, hiding, and uncertainty.
I mean, I remember my mom running from back and forth from the hall, from one end of the hall to the other, trying to find the answers. I'm like, are we going to die today?
But it wasn't war that Rukshana wound up running from in the end. She was forced to run from the very man who gave her life, but put her life at risk as well. This is her remarkable story of survival. Under the scorching heat of the Malawi sun, 5-year-old Rukshana uses a stick to draw in the dirt. A mango tree keeps Rukshana and her classmates shaded in their makeshift school.
I remember smoothing the ground and, you know, writing, you know, the letter R and U and practicing those, putting the words together and consonants together on the ground, on the floor. And then again, smoothing the ground and doing that. And we did that because, one, we didn't have pencils and paper. And two, the teacher did not have a chalkboard. She had whatever material with the worn out books that she got from old times. And she's teaching that.
It's a new place for the 5-year-old whose family, a mix of Black, Indian, and Portuguese, just fled from her birth country of Mozambique after it was believed her parents' involvement in the ongoing civil war would put her family in harm's way.
I remember my parents talking about they're going to be moving because of my dad. My father was in the military. He was into the military when he was 15. So he grew with the military as the military grew. So there was the opposing party, which is the Portuguese, and also the local party, which is the Mozambican party. So he was involved into the local political party. So because the Mozambique was still controlling Mozambique, they had a lot of secrecy about the weapons and the money and the finances. And because my mom worked in the bank, so they thought that they were doing something together, because she worked for the bank and she was, and my father would know then transfer the money of the weapons and the secret weapons and the bombs and the guns and things like that. So they thought that he hold that information.
As a child, Rukshana did not know the intricacies of her father's entanglement with the war, but now reflecting as an adult, she believes her father must have known critical details that ultimately could have helped Mozambique regain its independence.
People were disappearing. They are murdering them, and because of the war, so he knew that he was going to be the next, and his family was going to be the next, and the only way to do is leave the country. My vivid memory is leaving early, like at 3 o'clock in the morning, taking the truck somewhere to arrive to these pit stop, and we packed all our stuff with luggages and bags, and we put it on our heads, and we walked for 2-3 days on mountain ranges and crossing the streams, not knowing where the destination is. My parents knew because they hired somebody to take them across the country, which is in Malawi. And my vivid memory is just climbing mountains and, you know, being away from the city, because I grew up in the city, and then I saw, you know, I saw monkeys, I saw snakes, those are the vivid memories I had when I was five, crossing those mountains with families and carrying all our luggages and stuff, and finding ourselves in a small little village in Malawi. I don't think my parents knew what they're getting themselves into. And I think when you're in that war and survival mode, you leave hoping for the best and not knowing who is going to be on the other side to help you out.
Rukshana says her father thought he would have connections in Malawi to secure a home similar to the one that they left. But ultimately, the young family ended up living in a hut.
I remember waking up from the hut having welts on the ground because of bug bites, and we didn't have, comfortable beds. We just had we call it a kapulana. A kapulana is a regular rug that, women used to wrap around like a lungi, or put on the head, or carry the baby. And we just slept there with our clothes. And those are some of the stories and associating with what I remember. I don't think my parents knew what they were going to. Like a lot of refugees, when they leave their country, they don't know what to expect. They just hope for the best and hoping that there will be people on the other side to help them and figure it out.
While her parents went off to make money in any way they could, like being a truck driver for her dad or a seamstress for her mom, Rukshana attended school under the mango tree when she could. But as the eldest daughter, she ended up becoming the caretaker for her siblings at just 5 years old.
I lost that sense of a childhood. Not only that development stage from that age when I left the country to caretake for my siblings, but also moving on to other stages, I continue that series of caretaking. I think my brain just shut down that part of me because I feel like I was taking care of my siblings. I think that was a priority. And everything else, my brain's like, okay, I'm just existing. I'm just living.
During this time, Rukshana faced harm from her own father, the man who was supposed to be protecting the family, the man who was supposed to be making her feel secure.
I think at that time I was 10 years when we established in that town, that village. So I adapted to learning the language and experiencing their tribal language as well, and their foods and their culture. And I feel like that was also, for me, that was a pivotal moment where I was being sexually abused by my dad. I feel like that's part of a life. I think that, being in that time, in that moment, I thought that's part of it. It's like you're the daughter and you're being sexually abused. That's usually what happens.
Despite what was happening at home, the family's well-being remained top priority. And after only being in Malawi for just a few years, the family soon found themselves on the run yet again.
I have a feeling that my dad stirred up some stuff or stole something or stole a truck or stole something, and that we had to leave. And the only way to leave was head to Zambia in the refugee camp, because we couldn't go back to the country that we knew. Everything we had, we left. So we left our home, we left our cars, everything. So the only way that prompted us to do is to leave the country and go to Zambia.
In a successful attempt to block out that part of her memory, Rukshana can't recall the journey from Malawi to Zambia. She can't recollect the route they took, the mode of transportation, or the things they brought with them. But she does remember what followed her.
Whether it is molestation, I was still kid. I don't think I felt I had a way to leave. I didn't know where to go.
Now, in an overflowing Zambian refugee camp, the family had to live in a tent on the compound rather than living in one of the apartments that were at full capacity.
It was so crowded that they started putting the green army tents. So that's where we lived for 5 years. The green army tents were enough for our family of seven. So most family that came after a certain time, they would live in the green tents, and they would give you the blankets and the basic pots and pans for survival. But again, the tent, you think about those canvas green tents, which most of you will see them in the refugee camps and pictures that you see. They're waterproof, when you we live in a tropical weather, we get lots of rain and those big balls of ice. Sometimes it'll be, not snowing, but hail. those are so protective to, you could have like a little campfire in there and you're comfortable and cozy and warm.
But still, even confined to the small space of a tent, Rukshana's father continued the abuse.
You know, they say that the abuser always has a repetition of a habit or a play. So the play was he would make my mom upset and they would fight and he would hit her and my mom would take the kids and leave. So I would stay back and take care of the household. So that pattern went on forever.
But eventually, Rukshana found comfort outside the tent.
I just remember being in the refugee camp and living with so many people from different countries. At that time, there was also many wars happening in different, that surrounding. So that refugee camp became the hub of all the refugees that fled the countries around. You're all refugees. You all fled the country. So now we're all one family. It was one of those things that happens in the military. You have that bond that never leaves. So those families that had we had that community with became the also longtime friends. I think I feel like that where friendship started for me. That's where I learned about friendship. I started building friendships and, you know, staying after school or going together or learning something together. So, and when there was gatherings, we'll sit together or cook together.
But in those friendships, Rukshana learned she wasn't all that different, and that what was happening to her as a victim of child molestation was really quite common, or so it seemed.
Something similar was happening to them as well, because we would have those conversations. It was whether it was their uncle or their older brother. And again, it was such a part of a norm that nobody could talk about it outside, but you're talking about within inside.
While Rukshana was being abused by the man whose role should have been one of love and protection, her own role of being the eldest daughter and caregiver persisted.
One of the things I also remember vividly is because I'm the oldest child, so everybody had to wait in line to have a bell for meals. So when it was mealtime, they'll ring the bell and then everybody has to wait in line. It's so hot, like you can feel your skin peel. Like it's so the humid, the heat, and you talk about resilience. That is where I learned resilience. Like I, when someone would cut between the line, you know, I was probably 10, 11 years old, and I would be shoving and screaming and calling them names and putting myself out there and cutting in front of the line. And sometimes you don't know. One of the things is I'm in line. I didn't know if I'm going to make it to the beginning of the line to get food. So that's where my roughness comes in, and you know, trying to cut the line in between to make sure I'm not the last one in line to get food. And you wouldn't see kids waiting in line. There wasn't like, there were mostly parents, and it was just the basic food, boiling beans and water. And then you would take our buckets, you know, big bowl, plastic buckets, and you go in there and they scoop out a couple, you know, scoops, and then you would take it to the tent and then you would cook it for kind of like marinate it or season it, and you would eat it with the fufu, which is the cornmeal established meal. So that went on for a long time. But because now I had parents who had been there for a long time, so they're getting jobs outside, they would have a little money to buy like a little oil or a little vegetable. So they'll bring those things. Again, my job was to cook for my family to make sure my family was fed. So if there's anything that I learn about what I am today, it's that moment of resilience, of survival for food.
While Rukshana played the role of homemaker, her parents found work outside the camp, similar to their previous roles of driving trucks or finding sewing projects. But as they approached 5 years in a place meant to be temporary, conversations surrounding the family's next steps became increasingly more frequent.
There was no going back. And a lot of families were like, well, we're going to go back to Mozambique and hope. And we kept hearing stories like, oh, so-and-so went back and they passed away. So-and-so went back, the whole family was murdered, you know, things like that. So my parents knew that there was no going back to Mozambique. So at that time, they came into the refugee camp, and there were three countries that were giving asylum for people in the refugee camp who had been in there for more than 4 years and were just hitting about 5 years at that time. So they gave an application process, and we had to learn how to do a storytelling. Why is it we can't go back to our country? what is it, the hope that you want to create for your family? So my parents had to learn how to be great storytellers by applying for asylum. They applied for Canada. They didn't get it. They applied for Australia. They didn't get it. And they applied for United States. By the third time, they got it. And that's how we got to come to United States with sponsored by Catholic Charities. For me, I was like that sense of hope. And I'm like, okay, well, there's no going back to a country that I left, that I knew of. And my thought, I was like, you know, I hope to come back. I hope to come back in a certain time to be able to give back in a way that I can.
While dreaming of one day coming back to the Southeast African countries she called home, Rukshana had a new journey ahead of her, which started off with a big shock to her system.
That was scary. That was long. It was a very long flight, and it was exhausting, and everything we heard was not true. They said America is very cold. Well, it's in San Diego. It's not that cold. They gave us all these puffy jackets. And we arrived in San Diego. It was a 4th of July weekend. And people who were supposed to pick us up from the Catholic Charities were not there. So we ended up staying there for a while, maybe probably a whole day, until another lady saw us the day before. She's like, you guys have been here for a while. And she reached out to another organization to help us pick us up. Coming from, again, from a country of war, you know, having that fleeing, you know, the guns and the bombs and bombing of everything. So coming to the 4th of July, we got pizza delivered. This family picked us up from the airport. We got comfortable, took nice showers, was comfortable about probably at 10 o'clock at night. And the fireworks starts going on outside. It's the 4th of July. America's celebrating the big holiday gatherings of the 4th of July. And all these fireworks are going off, and my parents are freaking out to get under the bed and thinking that it's bombs. And my mom is going, because we're staying in a hotel at that time, she's going back and forth, freaking out and see what's going on. And people trying to figure out what she's saying and telling my family, get under the bed, don't get out, get under the bed. And again, thinking that we're in war. My parents were very freaked out. I mean, I remember my mom running from back and forth from the hall, from one end of the hall to the other, trying to find the answers of, like, are we going to die today? But again, it's just fireworks and someone tried to explain across from the building. She spoke Spanish and we're able to communicate very similar to Portuguese. I said, no, they're not bombs. They're just fireworks. They're celebrating and stuff.
Ready for a fresh start, Rukshana was cautiously eager to get out into what she saw as a world of opportunity.
Came to the United States and realized that I was almost 16 and life is different. So I had to learn again, adapting to the language and the culture and the experience and the learning experience. I feel like when I've done, everything was adaptation. So coming to United States, I feel like by the third time, I kind of knew what to do. I'm like, okay, here we go. Learning again, expanding and growing. By then I was 16. I went to go get a job and I was helping my parents again. And I was buying shoes for my siblings and I was buying school supplies for my siblings. Again, I went back into that pattern of caretaking in a different manner. There's some kind of part of my brain that shut down because I don't remember all the vivid stories that happened after that. I just remember when I was 15 and 16 when I thought I was pregnant. I think that was more pivotal because I remember the fear of getting up every day, not wanting to exist.
As Rukshana acclimated to the U.S., she started to understand that the abuse from her father was not a normal occurrence, but she worried about taking action.
Having friends and having those conversations where it came from, seeing that's a norm in Africa and kids in at the high school is like, no, that's not. You should report that to the police, you know. But also having those images, I'm like, you know, are they going to take my father away, or are they going to break the family, and what's next? So there was a lot of fear of that. The conversation you have with girls is like your period, you know, like how often do you get your period, you know, just the conversation. So that conversation would lead for me was like, you know, I haven't got my period in 3 months, and I'm stressed. And I'm stressed because, you know, I didn't have the keywords, but it was like, my father's having sex with me. And they look at me like, what? You crazy? Is this something you want? And, you know, like, you know, that's illegal. You know, having children's like, that's illegal to do that. I'm like, no, it's not illegal in Africa. That happens. I'm like, no, this is illegal here in the United States. So, you know, having the kids telling me that to call the police, but then there's fear of like, you know, I've heard stories like, you know, if the police come, it destroys the family. The families are separated and the kids are taken away from the care. Now you're no longer with your family anymore. So I felt responsible because I am the mother of my children, of my siblings. I was the caretaker of them. I worked. I had a full-time job after on weekends to buy them things that they needed. So I was very afraid of initiating that conversation, and I didn't know how to talk to the police and having that conversation, even just going to the authorities. I didn't even tell the teachers. It was a conversation among kids. But there was fear where I would be moments where I didn't get my period for 3 to 6 months. And I would be so scared. Like, I would be running and running, hoping that I don't want to be pregnant. I want this baby to come out as my period. Like, trying to, you know, as a child, you figure out, you don't know research, but you're trying to figure out how you can make it work without it affecting you. And I think every molested or sexual abuser would say, if you ever tell, your family will suffer, your family will not be together, they'll make you feel guilty, or it'll make you feel shame, like your family will never, nobody will believe you, you're such a liar, and such thing like that. I was in San Diego, and he said that if you ever tell, nobody will believe you. So he would do the same pattern. He would beat my mom, and then my mom would leave with the kids, and then I was there, and then he's got all the freedom to do whatever he wants. So whether it is molestation, I was still a kid. You know, I don't think I felt I had a way to leave. I didn't know where to go. Who I could have called the police, but I didn't know how. I didn't know what would take the step. But then, of course, I was in fear of, I am responsible for my family, so I will destroy my family for doing that as well. I was scared. I remember having my 16th birthday and I was paranoid. I was walking like I had clouds in my head. And I remember my neighbors like, what is wrong with you? You look like you are floating. And I'm like, I don't know. And then even my father notices like, what's wrong with you? Like, I did not get my period for 6 months and I really thought I was pregnant. And I was paranoid and I was scared and I didn't know what to do. I didn't know what's next. I tried to tell it to my mother and she didn't believe me. She tried to shut me down. I couldn't even tell to my siblings because they were younger. I was their protector. It got to a point that I was so afraid and I didn't know what I'm going to do. But mostly I was afraid of being pregnant. So I left the house. I went to stay with one of my friend's mom. And I told one of my friend's mom that I trusted very well. And then my friend's mom reported. And that's when the police came and interviewed me. They took me to the police station and recorded me. Again, I was so scared. It was such a different experience because I thought they're going to put me in jail because I reported. I felt like I did something wrong. So that in itself, I didn't know. So I didn't go to school for 2 days. I went to the beach. I just slept on the beach for 2 days. I was so afraid. And it wasn't until the police found me and then put me in a foster care.
After Rukshana had reported her father, the family did what they knew how to do best. Rukshana's parents took her siblings and fled San Diego and ran to Portland, Oregon. But what they didn't take into consideration was that the government could track where they were based on their usage of food stamps.
They found out that they were here, so the state came back and took the kids and took them back to San Diego, and my mom had to do all these work for her to get her kids back. So she had to leave my dad, she had to go to therapy, she had to take all these classes, she had to learn how to get a job and all those things and get her own place and then advocate for her kids to come back. And then what in the place for her to keep the kids, what are the things that she needed to do is for continue having therapy for the kids and her getting therapy to the kids.
While Rukshana's dad remained in Portland and her mom fought for custody of her kids in every way she could, Rukshana felt like her soul could finally breathe. Once in foster care with her siblings, she felt the darkness that once held her captive was no longer hers to carry. Though guilt washed over her, she still saw it as a chance at freedom, but she didn't feel like she could do it on her own.
Like, I need to find someone to take care of me. I need to be out of the house. I was exhausted. I feel like I just wanted to, like, somebody marry me, take care of me, you know, and I was tired of running around and all the responsibilities. And I didn't want to go back to Portland. I mean, I just wanted to stay in San Diego. So I feel like that was the only way that I was going to do that is, oh, I can't come back. I'm sorry. I turned 18 and I got married. So that was my big excuse.
So with that, Rukshana set out on a mission to get married. Not for love, but simply for the need of an escape. And she found that person during her first stint at getting a college degree.
He was the person I needed at that time. He listened to me. He validated me. And he wanted to help me. And I was in so much pain. I just needed a distraction. But I never told him everything. And I had 3 children with him. But what I realized is through that pain that I was going through, I had to open up and share some of those things with him because he did not know because he called me crazy. And yes, I was crazy because all these emotions just finally just came together all at once. Having children, marrying him, and then all the stuff from my past.
3 kids and several years of marriage later, Rukshana wanted more. She desired a career for herself, though her husband wanted her to stay home. In the midst of their disagreements and ultimately a divorce, Rukshana got a phone call.
My dad was dying with cancer.
The first man in her life, the one who abused, manipulated, and betrayed her, only had 8 more months left to live. And Rukshana felt she had some unfinished business. So she took this as her sign to move back to Portland and close this chapter that she never wanted to open.
Because he was in bed rest. He was dying. So I figured, like, I want to have those conversations, those uncomfortable conversations. I want to have peace. I don't want to him to die thinking that I wish I could say this. I wish you could say that.
Back in Portland, Rukshana helped her family take care of their ailing father.
It was those moments where I took shifts. He says, I don't expect you to forgive me. I never would. But if I'm going to die, but I want to go in peace. And if there's anything I've done wrong is to rob your... He did say exactly the words that I hoped to hear. I was hoping to hear him say, I'm sorry I hurt you. Oh, I'm sorry I robbed your youth. I'm sorry I robbed your childhood. I wanted him to say it so bad, I never thought I would ever hear it, but I hoped for it. And I never said anything. After he died, going back to those conversations reminded me that he did do what I hoped that he would say. Hearing him say that meant a lot to me.
It took many years with the help of therapy for Rukshana to accept her father's words. But in the end, she didn't do it for him. She did it for herself.
I wanted it for my own feeling of that sense of, you know, I don't want to live in my life thinking that my dad sexually abused me, robbed my teen life away from me, robbed my early childhood away from me. So I have this sense of not feeling like I am worthy. I wanted to have that sense of peace for myself. So whether it was for him, for me, it created sense of peace as I went on to where I am today, like, you know, having a relationship with other men.
While the peace Rukshana found in her dad's apology may have been too late for her first marriage, she was able to direct that peace onto her next love, and she even found it in her heart to honor her father during that union at her wedding.
I wanted his picture to be there because it's also a representation of all the people that knew him. And I wanted people to respect him for who he is, but also he played a role in whether it is in my growth or my anger. That all those experiences that led me to the peace that I have, the relationship that I have, I wouldn't have that until I brought his picture on the wedding.
From darkness and trauma to light and healing, forgiving the unforgivable, Rukshana went on to forge a new life she'd made for herself and by herself, but for the benefit of others. Now 50, Rukshana works as a life coach, dedicating her life to inspiring other women with her story. But of course, she couldn't forget about her beloved African countries.
The nonprofit is called Frimina Foundation, which is in honor of my grandmother, my mom's mother. It was established to focus on building schools in those little villages that doesn't have a school. So we pop different schools in different villages. We have built a first school that was finished 2 years ago. It has it was built in this little village called Tengwa. It's in Mozambique. And we started out with 13 students there learning under a mango tree. Now there is 390 students going to school. So instead of kids farming, now they have a rhythm of life going to school and learning, hoping to build education and inspire those future kids to learn and do better for their country.
Many Roads to Here is a production of The Immigrant Story. This episode was produced, audio edited, and hosted by me, Amel El-Hel. Special thanks to Fran Silverman for script editing and to Greg Palmer for post-production support. Our executive producer is the fabulous Sankar Raman. Thank you to St. Andrew Lutheran Church in Beaverton, Oregon, for letting us use their space to record this interview. This episode is made possible by a generous contribution from the Zeidel Family Foundation. For more stories, visit theimmigrantstory.org/manyroads, listen live at prp.fm, or stream us wherever you get your podcasts.